Welcome to the Infotainment podcast series looking inside Europe at the impact of social media on politics and the rise of populist political forces. I'm Damien Collins, and in this show, we'll be focused on France. And I'm delighted to be joined for the podcast by Theo Lenoir from the Institut Montaigne and Rudy Reichstadt, the CEO and founder of Conspiracy Watch. Thank you both for joining us on the podcast. Perhaps we could just start off by looking at what general impact do you think social media has had on politics in France? Do you think it has played a role in giving a voice to more populist political forces?
So if I can begin, I would say that social media have the same impact as they can have on the political life of democracies comparable to France. Twitter, in particular, has been heavily invested by politicians and activists. It is common for controversy to arise on Twitter. Many elected officials, politicians, and journalists react to trending topics on Twitter. This platform is sometimes still used as a classic communication tool where institutions post the press releases or are present through very standardized and marked out campaigns. We can add that the president of the French Republic, Emmanuel Macron, is on Twitter with more than 7 million followers. And he has invested TikTok and Instagram. For example, last summer to answer questions about vaccination from the young audience in particular. You have another French politician with Jean-Luc Mélenchon, the leader of the left-wing populist party, La France Insoumise, who is very present on TikTok too, to speak to the youth. We can add that there are also the Telegram loops, Telegram threads, with thousands of subscribers. This is a platform often where you find often the most toxic accounts that have been deleted, suppressed from YouTube or Facebook or Twitter, and they take refuge on Telegram or on another platform, Russian platform like VKontakte. Or an American platform of videos, such as Odyssey. You have a lot of toxic conspiracist media and anti-Semitic and denialist and racist media, which take refuge on these new platforms.
Yeah, and maybe if I can react, I mean, I think, you know, it's really difficult to try to assess the impact of social media on democracies in France and elsewhere. I think we're seeing some changes in how information ecosystems work, and social media is definitely a part of it. You have obviously impacts on several types of actors. I think citizens obviously have now a capacity to mobilize and also share information through social media, politicians, and Rudy, you're completely right in saying that the strategies of political actors are changing with new means of communication. There is also a change for journalists, and I think that a lot of topics that emerge in public discussions now that occur on the media are spotted by journalists through social media. So there is maybe a new way to listen to political conversations for journalists. And then I think it's also important to note that for think tanks, social media have been a major game changer. In any job where you're task is to try to keep up to date with information and to be aware of figures that are created by such and such actor. Obviously, social media play a very important role. And maybe just adding one thing, it's you have how social media have changed the way we communicate. But what I find also fascinating is the way social media has an, as an object have changed our realization of the quality of public debates. And, you know, the whole debate around fake news and hateful speech have raised very interesting questions on what we assume to be public debates and how we think they are of high quality when actually they're not always of as quality as we'd like, you know? So there is really that realization and it's really pointing a finger at some of the issues that democracies are facing and were facing beforehand, but maybe it was less visible.
Earlier in this series, when we looked at Germany and the build-up to the German federal election, it was interesting that we discussed the fact that Alternative for Deutschland, the right-wing party in Germany, although only getting about 10% of the vote, had by far the biggest share of voice in on social media in Germany. Do you think it's similar in France? Do you think that in social media in France for political discussion, that it tends to favor the more populist and extreme parties?
I would say that the most extreme parties might be more represented on social media, which doesn't mean that they are more represented offline. I think a very interesting book on this is the work of Chris Bale at Duke University at the Polarization Lab, who is looking at what contributes to polarization and trying to push back against the idea that social media play a determining role in polarizing societies. And what he's pointing towards is just the fact that moderate voices are not present most of the time on social media. And so I would definitely agree in saying that content that are related to more extremist political parties might create more engagement, but it's probably because their partisans are more inclined to use social media and to be vocal on social media.
And I just would add that there is something that is common to social media and populism. They all plays on emotion. Reason, rationality, reflection are not adapted to this environment. They are not competitive. And for instance, this is what the French sociologist Gerald Bronner describes in his latest book, where he shows how the reign of the immediate and the intuitive imposes itself to the detriment of long time and rationality.
And do you think there's evidence of continued foreign interference in politics in France through social media? There was evidence of some Russian involvement around the last presidential election. Has this continued to be a factor in France?
I began, Théophile. It's okay for you. Actually, you have the maintenance by the Kremlin of a network of state media outlets such as Russia Today, RT, or Sputnik, which make no secret of the desire to improve the image of Russia. The problem is that this media act as propaganda media. This was said in extremely firm terms by President Emmanuel Macron at the very beginning of his term of office during a joint press conference with Vladimir Putin in Versailles. Then there are matters that come under the heading of disinformation operations, like the Macron leaks, when more than 20,000 emails related to the campaign of Macron during the 2017 French presidential election, and today before the final vote. The emails were shared on social media like Facebook and Twitter by several French far-right political activists and by WikiLeaks as well. And for 3 years now, there has been the amplification of movements like the Yellow Vest or the anti-vax in order to, as Théophile said, to polarize our societies, to hysterize the public debate. That's it.
Yeah, if I mean, it's very difficult to say that, you know, there is no operation that target France. But I think a few things. First of all, I think in France we still miss, you know, a very strong research environment that is able to document in real time operation that could target France. So we have hints of things that could be happening through what we see on the websites of Russia Today and Sputnik, and we have you know hints that actors could be amplifying these messages and making them circulate on social media. But to date, we don't have very in-depth analysis of how networks would manage to do that. There are exceptions, though. Obviously, the research that was done on the 2017 election is very well documented and shows how Russian agents, through in interaction with the alt-right, in the US, have shared documents that were intended to compromise the election. And more recently, you have a report again by ESM, which is a think tank linked to the military in France, that just published a report on the impact of China on information operations. And it's interesting to see how they use both social media, of course, but also content farms to try to produce content that can have an impact on politics. And they also use very traditional channels to try to influence discussions in France. And the Chinese embassy has a significant role in these information operations. So yeah, I would say we still miss a very clear eye of who is targeting us in real time, and we really need this actually. At Institut Montaigne, we published a research with a researcher, Alexa Pavlyuk, who works at the Oxford Internet Institute, and who tried to identify the number of messages that were targeting France in a series of information operations that were shut down by Twitter. And the percentage is actually very low. These were operations before 2018, so again, you know, things could have changed. And also maybe the operations targeting France were not spotted by Twitter. That's another explanation. But still, in the operations before 2018, France was not targeted massively. And I think language might play an important role in this. And I'd be curious to know how the situation is in Germany, for instance. But I think language is still a barrier to massive operations. And it's actually something also that the ESM, the military think tank I was mentioning, quoted in their report on Chinese operations.
That's interesting because on language, because there are obviously a lot of evidence around networks that operate in English and Spanish, targeting different communities around the world. But do you think there's not been the same investment in disinformation in the French language?
This is one of the conclusions we were reaching through that research by Alexa Pavlyuk. But again, you know, we might be finding soon some operations that target France and that use very high level, highly sophisticated French, and maybe that will happen. But for now, we don't have evidence of sophisticated French attacks. And the Macron leaks is a perfect example of this. One of the reasons why some say that it failed is because most of the messages were shared in English.
That is very interesting. I mean, in terms of topics that are used in other countries, it seems that disinformation networks choose topics that they know are going to be very divisive. So debates around migration, you know, is often a divisive topic. I mean, do you think in France, again, that where social media is used by disinformation networks, they are again trying to pick topics where they know there's controversy, they know opinion is divided?
I would say yes, for sure. And again, this is where we shouldn't be looking at online disinformation only, and more importantly, we shouldn't be looking at disinformation without understanding the social context in which it spreads. And one thing that is very interesting in France, and it's happening right now, is how right-wing parties are trying to use immigration as one of their topics for the political campaign in light of the presidential election that will come in April. And so this is a very sensitive topic in France, which is dividing political parties. And obviously, it's a perfect field for disinformation and information operations. And it's even more relevant in light of the debate that has been happening around Recep Erdogan and the conflicts with Emmanuel Macron last year, when Erdogan was criticizing Macron's position on the caricatures of anti-Islam caricatures. I mean, not anti-Islam caricatures, but caricatures of the religion. And obviously, this is a very sensitive topic, and Macron was offended by some of the messages that were said to twist what he intended to say originally, and this led to high conflicts at a very high level.
And I would add another topic, which is all regarding the origin of the SARS-CoV-2, of the COVID-19, and the policy in and the vaccination policy. This is a door where foreign propaganda can enter.
If I could just ask about COVID, because there was a lot of research done last year looking at the levels in different European countries of people's attitude towards a COVID vaccine. So a lot of this research was done before the vaccine was delivered and being rolled out. But it suggested that there was a high and increasing level of the number of people that said they wouldn't take the COVID vaccine. And that was high in lots of countries in Europe. In France, it was probably amongst the highest. I think at one point it was over half of people said they wouldn't take the vaccine. I mean, do you think, you know, in your opinion, was this a big topic of discussion in France? Are there reasons why you think the level of concern about the vaccine was so high?
I think there were vaccine hesitancy before the COVID-19 crisis, and we saw it growing progressively, it literally explodes. I don't know if we can say that with the COVID-19 crisis. But what we can say is that 9 months after the beginning of the vaccination campaign, the number of French citizens who took the vaccine is huge, and the majority of the people has been vaccinated in spite of this defiance against vaccine. So we are now one of the European country with the most important level of vaccinated people.
Yeah, it's the vaccination topic is very puzzling. So anti-vax sentiments were very high in France prior to the COVID, and it was definitely one of the highest in the world. But what Rudy is saying is completely true. I'm looking at the map now of vaccination rates in Europe. And so in France, it's 65.8% of people that are completely vaccinated. And in Germany, we have 64.2%. In the UK, it's 67.2%. So it's the question is, why was before COVID anti-vax sentiment was already so high? And there would need to do some research on this. But I think one hypothesis is also the link through Canadian actors between France and US conspiracy theories. And maybe you have information on this, but the whole debate around vaccination and its link to autism was deeply influenced in France by what was said in the US around that topic. And so there is an hypothesis to make, which is that you have operators in Canada that translate some of the messages in conspiracy theory that happen in the US and that circulates back in French-speaking countries, including France.
I mean, there's been a lot of work done in the last couple of years looking at how we try and address the problem of disinformation and other harmful content online and on social media. And in Europe, that has been led by the European Commission's proposals for the Digital Services Act. But after the French presidential election, President Macron's government also looked at introducing legislation around disinformation during elections. Do you think France is better placed to deal with disinformation at the election next year? And do you think the proposals that have been set out to try and create responsibilities for the social media companies to act against known harmful networks of disinformation, do you think they're going to be effective?
Better prepared, because obviously the debate has been evolving for some time now, and everyone is well aware of the risk of disinformation. That's for sure. Then in terms of concrete actions, the government is creating, and it will be launched this month, an agency, Viginium, which is 100% focused on looking at foreign interference during the election. And they're supposed to hire 40 people by the end of 2021 and have 65 people working there by the end of April 2022. So you have some resources coming from government that will be directly allocated to overseeing disinformation. Now, on the legal front, there is the law from 2018 that looks directly at disinformation. It's been criticized because it's only asking, it's creating a legal process through which content that is manifestly illicit, it's creating a process where a judge can order the platform to delete it, and it has to do so within 48 hours. So you have that process in place, but which gives all the responsibility on deletions to platforms and doesn't really help us understand how the systems work, how they deal with these issues, what resources they have to cope with these issues. I think more interesting on the issues of content more generally, and not necessarily only disinformation, you have two laws that were passed that have an impact on regulation. The first one is the Loi Avia on hateful speech. A lot of what was inside the law was actually later on deleted by the Constitutional Council in France. But still, you have an observatory which will be run by the Conseil Supérieur de l'Audiovisuel, which is the agency in charge of regulating media and now social networks. So that's one topic. And then a second topic is the Loi Séparatisme, which already introduces some of the regulation that is proposed by the Digital Services Act. And perhaps the most interesting part of it is not necessarily what's related to illegal content, but to other forms of content, where we're asking platforms to evaluate the risk that their systems pose for society, then the actions they take to mitigate these risks, and then to evaluate how these actions have been efficient to reduce the risks. And this is probably the most clever way of proceeding, whereby we ask platforms to take action and evaluate the actions they take and then to communicate this information to the regulator to check if everything is run correctly.
No, I think it's very difficult to say if the public debate in France will be polluted or not by disinformation campaigns. We have to mention the law against the manipulation of information voted in November 2018. It only concerns the framework of an election, not another period. Outside the period of an election, this law is cannot be used. Moreover, you have all the initiative from the civil society, which are supported by the French government in order to fight against fake news, conspiracism, conspiracy theories, etc. We benefit we as an organization of this policy to produce contents which argument against conspiracy theories which point people and influencers work with these things, and I think the government cannot do everything, you know.
I was interested, Theo, in what you said earlier about the government regulator that can audit how the companies are responding to harmful content and disinformation. Do they have the power to sort of get data from the companies, or do they, as is in the case in Germany, do they rely on self-reporting from the companies about what they've done?
So the companies have to send information to the regulator. And actually they did so in March last year, and the CSR, the regulator, just published last week its recommendations based on the assessment it's made of the reports shared by 14 platforms. Mm. So they have to share information on this. It's not clear to what extent the CSR is actually auditing the companies and on which basis it would commit audits. So it has the ability to ask for specific information, and platforms have to be transparent. But the mechanism through which regulators can check whether that information is accurate is not perfectly clear.
Yeah, yeah. Because I think that's there's a question about self-declared results. The companies say what they've done, but they often don't give you much context as to how big the problem is. They tell you how much they've removed, or the percentage they've removed, but not necessarily how much there was that could have been removed.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that was one of the criticism of the approach undertaken by the European Commission on that voluntary code of practice and sharing of information. I think it's true that there is, it's definitely a challenge to have access to accurate information, and we have to find the means to do so. I also think that those voluntary codes of practice were a very good introductory run to kind of cover these issues. So we definitely need to go forward and to have more obligation for platforms to share information and means to check that information. But I think we are not now living a movement which is quite positive, where at least all of the platforms are very much aware of the issue and already have started to share some information on this and put in place inside the organization some processes to try to access that information.
Do you, I mean, one of the questions that has come up in this series so far is that when you look at the scale of disinformation, particularly on online, and the role that plays in politics, I think there's a question about how effective it is. And one of the things that seems to make it more effective is if there is a greater reliance on social media as a source of news, and that mainstream media, television and newspapers are distrusted. And how do you think that situation stands in France today? Do you think that traditional media is still well respected and still has the attention of voters?
Well, so we published a few years ago a study that was undertaken with Sciences Po, and the idea was to duplicate a research that was done in the US on polarization, a research by Yohai Benkler and Ethan Zuckerman and their team working on the impact of social media on polarization in the US. So it was looking at the media ecosystem in the US and trying to understand how polarized it was. And so we did the same research in France and found out a few differences with the American ecosystem, which are quite interesting. The first one is that in the US, polarization occurs on a horizontal axis. So you have politicians, the media that are related to them, and people that share information on social media linked to politicians and the media. They all have different ecosystems. So you have a fracture that goes from the politicians all the way to the citizens with different media ecosystems. In France, it's very different because actually politicians all share the same media, whether they're from the left, Libération, or whether they're from the right, Le Figaro. So you have a very centralized media space in France that is still very solid and resilient. However, what's worrying is that you see obviously new media emerging at the fringe, which are more extremist, we could say extremist media. Some of them sharing some weird types of information, and most of them being very highly politicized. And the question is now to know to what extent these fringe media can have an impact on that central group of media. So to what extent we'll see actors like Le Figaro start sharing information that might have circulated in other media spheres to reach different audiences. And so this is really something that, it's quite puzzling in the way the media ecosystem works in France and how it might evolve. But today, I would still say that media, still play a very central role, and traditional media are still central in the political spheres, but levels of defiance are rising.
Théophile, I think, was referring to what is called in French the reinfosphere. There are so-called reinformation sites, websites, that start from the principle that the classic professional mainstream media actively lie, or lie by omission, or disinform in any case. So they claim to re-inform the public. However, they are mostly alternative media with a strong conspiracist bias and with a strong extreme right bias too. Identitarian, nativist, sovereignist, nationalist. You have traditional Catholics and Islamist medias too. This is what we call here reinfosphere.
And finally, just before we close, I mean, there's been studies done in America looking at the 2020 presidential election and news and disinformation there. And I think one of the things that's was interesting coming out of that was that there's a greater emphasis now on people within the country who are, if you like, super spreaders of disinformation. They are people who have high followings on social media and a big audience, and that they play an increasing role in driving the spreading of conspiracy theories in election times and other times as well. And do you think that is similar in France? Are there movements or individuals who are who've got big followings, and their what they say can drive engagement around particular topics, including disinformation.
At Conspiracy Watch, we used to map the conspiracist, the French-speaking conspiracist ecosystem, the conspiracy sphere. And we have the 10 first websites classed by connections. They represent 14 million of connections per month. So it's not nothing. It's not nothing at all. And yes, they are super spreaders of this kind of contents, conspiracy contents, and anti-Semitic and racist, and xenophobic contents.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there is a country where you wouldn't have super spreaders. And I mean, again, interactions on social media are fascinating because the numbers can be quite scary when you start looking at them in terms of interactions that are created by different accounts. One of the examples was the controversy around Didier Raoult and chloroquine during the COVID crisis. And there were on Facebook pages that were created to share information on Didier Raoult. And those pages had more engagement in 2020, in the whole year of 2020, when the group was only created in March. The group had more engagement than those of media like Le Monde and Le Figaro. And again, that points to that question of, you know, who wants to speak on social media? And when they want to speak on social media, they'll be also much more active than people that are more moderate. So that could also explain why the most extreme and sometimes shocking content and in some cases the disinformation that creates anger and hatred are most successful and why you would have super spreaders.
Thank you for that, and thank you both for joining me on the podcast. You've been listening to the Infotagen Inside Europe podcast focused on France, hosted by me, Damien Collins, with our guests Theo Lemoire and Rudy Reichstadt. This show was produced by David Dargahi, and you can find out more about Infotagen at our website, infotagen.com, and also support this show by becoming a Patreon at patreon.com/infotagenpodcast. Infotagen is a non-for-profit organisation, and any funds we raise go towards the making of this show. Thank you. Until next time.